So what I'm going to present is on looking at the Colorado Youth Risk Behavior Survey data, and just to examine the relationships with antecedent risks for HIV/AIDS. I mean, we were motivated by the fact that this state for some years did not allow in-school HIV/AIDS education. So just wanted to examine the relationships between not having in-school education and some antecedent risk. So this is my name, Stephen Nkansa Mankra. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Northern Colorado. Teach epidemiology and environmental health. So usual disclaimer, and I just want to point out that this paper has, since submission of the abstract, been published in Maternal and Child Health Journal in August. So these are the learning objectives. We wanted to describe patterns with the Colorado Youth Risk Behavior data. And as I said, our interest is mainly to examine some antecedent risk, which for some time has not been done with that data. And then we also wanted to assess the role of social context. The definition of social context here was quite restrictive. We wanted to examine to what extent are some behaviors like reported sexual assault really was a major factor. So the purpose for this presentation is just to evaluate the relationships among sexual risk behaviors, HIV/AIDS education, and other antecedent risk exposures among adolescents with Colorado data. Colorado Youth Risk Behavior Survey. And just a little background, some of which has been mentioned. I mean, one thing that struck us as researchers was trying to understand among all the industrialized countries, this country still continued to lead in terms of HIV reporting and even mortality. And so we wanted to also look at what is the trend in Colorado. So we tried to do some kind of comparative analysis of the national data and then that of Colorado data. And we believe that it looks like, according to literature, the trend in terms of HIV infection and reporting is set to continue. And that has been quite clearly demonstrated with my previous presenters. So minorities are still likely to be infected and affected. And across the nation, as of 2008, 1 in 4 adolescent females has been diagnosed with at least one common STI. And these are really major antecedent risks for easy getting the infection easily. And then similar patterns have really also been observed for the reporting of some risk exposures among adolescents in Colorado. And for example, in 2007, non-Hispanic, Black, and Latina had the highest birth rates. I mean, if adolescents are having unprotected sex, obviously pregnancy could be a proxy for determining some kind of risk. And then specific STIs have also been accurately been reported. So we felt there was a compelling need for us to examine these relationships. So we wanted to understand the pattern of antecedent sexual risk behaviors. And we also, as I said, for some time, the state of Colorado did not mandate in-school HIV education, sexuality education, let me put it that way. And so we wanted to see what are the relationships are. If students who reported having had sexuality education from wherever, not necessarily from the school, what is their relationship with the antecedent risk I've mentioned? So the design and method, this essentially, as I said, is a secondary data analysis. We use Colorado Youth Risk Behavior Survey of 2005. And in that year, just briefly, Youth Behavior Risk Survey targets students from grade 9 to 12. And in Colorado in 2005, the response rate was about 60%, which was relatively low. And number of students that were sampled were about 1,498. But for the purpose of analysis, I think some with missing data were excluded from analysis. And as you might be aware, Youth Risk Behavior Survey is a survey. It's a design survey. It has weight attached because some minority groups are purposively sampled, and therefore weights are added just to make it representative of the population. So our major variables we examine here, the first one was the sexual risk behavior. And this we define as a 3 levels consisting of whether the student reported having more than two partners in the last month whether the student had sex but did not use any condoms or contraception. And so we had three levels: students who did not have any sexual contact in the 3 months, those who had about sex but protected themselves. We categorized that group as a relatively low risk. But those that did not use any kind of contraception, had more than two partners, were described as a high risk group. And then we also had age at first sex, categorized as less than 14, above 14, and those who did not have sex at all. And the number of sexual partner, none, one, and more than two. So these were our major outcome variables that we examined. And the independent variables that we look at were, of course, gender, those who reported having been physically being forced to have sex, and then HIV AIDS education, whether you did receive or did not. And substance use, grave smoking, these are all known to be strong correlates of HIV. So that's the reason why we did that. So obviously, we did the statistical analysis. We used the chi-square to look at the discrete variables. And then since this is the outcome variable was really three-level, we used multinomial logistic regression just to look at the three different relationships. And so we, of course, we determined statistical significance at 0.05. So the descriptive, I will just give a brief descriptive summary. We had about 64% non-Hispanic whites and 24% black, and other minorities constituted about 12%. So this was a representation quite reflect the distribution across the state. So overall, almost 5% reported having been forced to have sex. The adolescent, 32.3, had high-risk sexual behavior, and 11% used more than three substances, illicit substances. 30% had more than two partners in a month before the survey. And 85%, approximately 85% of students reported having received HIV/AIDS education. And this is an interesting part which I will discuss. And then male participants had a higher prevalence of sexual risk behavior, many of which had already been reported in the literature. So these were the results of our multinomial logistic regression. As I said, the outcome variables were three levels. And so multinomial logistic regression was what was used. And so the most important predictor for sexual risk behavior was being a male. Of course, males had higher propensity to be more at higher risk. And then, of course, Hispanic population. And students who reported having been physically forced to have sex, they were at risk for all the three outcome variables. And then the risk categories of current drinking had strong relationship with our three outcome variables. Of course, we did not find any statistically significant relationship between having had in-school HIV AIDS education and the end of the sexual risk behavior, which we will discuss shortly. So in other words, when students reported that whether they did have education, it really didn't matter in terms of your risk, higher sexual risk behavior, age at which they will have sex, and even the number of current partners. And the interesting point, part I need to point out here, is how the question was framed. I mean, the question was just like, have you had HIV education? And really, it can be anything. And so probably, as I said, I would have some discussions on that. So again, the results of the ordinary logistic regression for age of sexual debut, age between indicated higher risk for adolescent males. So the males were really, and then the black population, the Hispanics, and then, so this, in terms of the racial groups, the blacks and Hispanics were at a higher risk of early sex. And then there was also eightfold for young people reporting having been physically forced to have sex. And then for similar thing held for the racial groups reporting having had more than one sexual partner. So in terms of discussion, putting these results briefly, the brief presentation in the context, I think we can just indicate that overall, yes, we know there has been declines, but of course, we are aware up to this time there's no visible cure in sight. So what it means that probably the prevention will still continue to be important. And therefore, based on the results, the potential for young people in this state, at least for the past 5 or 6 years, to be having HIV, it's that great. And of course, the subsequent reports have clearly shown. So with respect to HIV, the interesting part is that, of course, 85% reported having had education. But the question here is, what does it mean? I mean, really being asked, did you have education? I mean, it can be, as I said, it can be anything. But in-school education at the time of 2005 was not really being conducted. So it's most likely young people might have had education from their peers, from other sources, which really does not lead to development of HIV/AIDS competence in terms of prevention. So it's most likely, in as much as people, young people reported having had some levels of education, it doesn't really match with the levels of their risk, three levels of risk we describe in this study. So obviously, it also indicates that probably the type of education they have might have received is, as I said, is not enough to build adequate competence. And of course, one explanation one can give is that there was limited variability because almost 85% indeed indicate that they have had that education. So in terms of social context, this is one of the things that as prevention scientists and behavioral researchers and have not really been able to focus on. This was reporting of having been forced to have sex was the most consistent predictors for all the three outcomes we discussed in the study. And the question here that we as researchers pose to ourselves is, to what extent that will young people be able to change behaviors when some of them are consistently being forced to have sex against their will? So I think that it also tells us that probably as community partners, as a prevention scientist, it's not enough to just look at individuals' behavior. Sometimes the social context to which these risks, to which adolescents are much more prone to, becomes much bigger problem. So it's another way that we could look at how do we design interventions to capture much of social context that young people do not have much control. So developing adequate competencies among most vulnerable adolescent population, particularly young girls and boys, of course. So implications of this finding, really, it's situated, again, in the context of the old debate, providing education, sexuality education in school, and versus abstinence. But of course, a lot of evidence have really shown that when young people are provided with well-designed sexuality education, it delays sex, age at which they will have first sex. So, but at least for some time in this state, this debate was just restricted to being having abstinence-only education. And I've mentioned, and in future, we are thinking of examining the multi-level relationship between reporting of forced sex and individual level factors. How does that correlate? To what extent the higher level factors that people do not have control, young people do not have control, are the real determinant of risk? So these are a few limitations. This is a cross-sectional study, and as usual, we can't infer causation. We can't infer causality. We can just correlate our responses. And of course, self-reporting of sexual risk behavior sometimes is also subject to error. And there were other limitations that we can't. So all in all, I think efforts to control the epidemic, we still need to have a sustained effort to not to relax, but to continue with our preventive effort, because the antecedent risk, the risks are still there among young people, and we know that HIV, people contract HIV at a younger age, so we still need to probably intensify efforts. And then another implication is also to design a more targeted intervention, since this has been proven to be more effective than just young people saying that, oh, we had education on HIV. So this is the end of my story, and maybe during question time, I'll be able to respond. Thank you for your attention.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we don't have a moderator, so we're, I guess, all gonna Right.
Oh, okay. You're the moderator? Oh, okay. Well, yeah. So feel free to ask questions. That's a very good question. I think that there are some behaviors that do occur while people are incarcerated, but there are things, I guess, a denial potentially of being able to have sex drives people sometimes once they get out to be a little bit more risky.
Okay. I have a question for Jessica.
Yeah.
Jessica, I was curious if any of the young men reported having sexual relationships with men who are much older than them.
Yes, I did read, I think I had mentioned that, it did, the mean age of the sample was 22, and they were, some of them reported engaging in sexual activity with older men, and by older, they operationalized it as anywhere from 25 to 35.
Actually, I also have a question for you. I'm just curious if they talked about their positive experiences with their partners and what that looked like at those different time points?
Some of that did come out. What was interesting is that with some partners, they may disclose or discuss either condom use or have some discussion about their HIV status. And what was interesting, and then this is something that we really need to look at for future research, is what is it that motivates them to actually disclose with some partners and not others? Mm-hmm. And so that's a pretty interesting question. And I don't think that there was any particular pattern that emerged, except to say that, yes, so if you had four partners, you may have disclosed or discussed condom with three, and as opposed to all four of them, kind of thing. So it did come.
I guess part of my question is the way the interview protocol, what emerged, it didn't seem like there was much talk about their relationships, and it just seemed very focused on how it related to their HIV status as coming out.
Oh, yeah.
Really the emotions around the.
Right.
Area.
Yeah, the whole thing about the partner characteristics is what we assess quantitatively. So there were these specific questions how many partners do you have, which, and then we ask about the four partners and who did you discuss condom with or discuss that sort of thing. Yeah, exactly. So it was really, really kind of focused in that regard. But good question. Yes.
My question is also for you.
Uh-huh.
Very rich data set, and I look forward to reading more of it. My question had to do with the role of schools.
Mm-hmm.
Did that come up very much among the students? Were the schools playing a positive role at all?
We didn't really get anything. The only mention made about schools really had to do with that it was a venue where they potentially met some of their sexual partners. I mean, some of these individuals, of course, were in school, but we did not actually get a whole lot of information around specific to, the school and school system and that sort of thing. Sorry. I'm sorry?
I was just saying it's a program.
It's a program. It's not exactly. We are CBO. This came out of, this research came out of a community-based organization. Yes.
Policy approaches, health communication approaches, things that you can that we as a community in public health can do to make that less controversial? I mean, what has been looked at in terms of being successful in overcoming controversies in risk reduction?
Thank you. That's an interesting question. And this same kind of discussion nearly led us to somehow deviating from the paper, because it's more about, it's an ideological viewpoint, not really the science. The science behind it really is extremely weak. And we reviewed almost 70 papers. I mean, papers that presumably showed the relationship between abstinence and the evidence was overwhelming. I think, coming back to your question, once it's an ideological stand, I think we need to continue the debate, probably understand, and we believe that as a researcher, we believe that, yes, we also need to understand their viewpoint and then come with the science. And I think that is probably one of the ways, the element of communication, probably is one of the ways that we can probably give the evidence, but we need to recognize that absolutely, it's more of an ideological than the science base behind it. So that's what I would say.
Yes, I mean, that's something. Another thread I saw throughout the panel is that it seems like race and ethnicity is very important. I'm a visiting scholar, and I teach at the Center for Study of Ethnicity and Race at Columbia University, and I do feel like. Another thing I've heard in the panel was the need for targeted interventions. I do think we need more racial and ethnic and neighborhood-specific interventions. And there was a piece I wasn't able to talk more about, is this idea of historical trauma. And I think if in the research on Native American Two-Spirit people, there has been this linkage of looking at historical trauma, looking at it scientifically, finding that Two-Spirit Native Americans actually experience more historical trauma than heterosexual Native Americans, and this is part of the compounded trauma they experience in addition to their own personal trauma. So to create an intervention that addresses not only their own personal experiences, but the intergenerational transmission of trauma that has been racialized, because they looked at historical trauma through connected to genocide, forced relocation, et cetera, in Native American contexts. I feel like we really need to do more of that with African American, Latino, and Asian American, other types of populations, to really address that there is a kind of, I think, collective trauma that is being experienced that gets kind of filtered through in different ways. And part of that is that, you know, there is evidence showing that in families of color, gender atypical and sexual minority youth and children are targeted more. Now, this doesn't mean that families of color are somehow pathologically more homophobic or transphobic, but it does mean that there is a certain kind of trauma that's getting passed down that's not being addressed at the core. And so I feel like that is something that really needs to happen. And I think it's going to really necessitate a lot of collaboration from people with different skill sets and knowledges.
I just want to add to that. I think it's a really interesting question, because in the early days of the HIV epidemic, I think we were talking much more openly and directly about high-risk behaviors, about condoms, about contraceptives. Of course, the pendulum swung completely in the decade or so after that to this abstinence-only approach, and I'd like to think that it has begun to swing back, certainly from the perspective of federal funding. So hopefully, we'll start to see an end to that ostrich type of approach to young people's sexual behaviors. So I had two questions. One was for Eric. I was actually fascinated about the fact that these homeless youth were actually using the library as a resource, and I would imagine that prior to the internet, the library was not a place where you could find homeless youth. And so that, just as a whole separate aside, interested me as a potential site for intervention.
Yes and no. I mean, you have to remember that public libraries
by definition, their funding sources are public spaces, and so homeless folks oftentimes use libraries as places where they can go to stay warm, to stay dry, and you can't sleep there overnight, so you can get out of the elements for the day, and you can't be kicked out because you know, if you just go to the library, you're looking at a book, or if you get lost in a chair, that's okay. So they were going there, but now, if you go into a public library these days, and you will see, you know, tables and tables and tables of people on their computers, and this is kind of on the kind of public computers, and a lot of those, at least a lot of the youth that I work with, the community agencies that I work with, are using the public libraries to get online. Yes. So I mean, I think that the shelter aspect of the libraries has always been there, but now there's this whole informational aspect to it that's new. I mean, I think before maybe you grab a book to pass some time, but that's about now this plan that was more instrumental things that they can do with. Well, but I mean, also they get online and look at, actually asking some questions about when you look at pornography online, and there's also the library was the number one place where they do that. So I mean, you're using the library to kind of, you know, everyone who's wanting a computer of their own, so.
Just suggesting that it's for potentially interesting interventions like this.
Oh, absolutely.
I think the majority of us would think of right offhand as a place where it's fine.
No, I think that's very thing.
And my other question actually was for Stephen about HIV education in Colorado versus abstinence education, because even though it was at the time an abstinence-only curriculum, and I don't know whether it still is, was there a separate HIV education requirement that was somehow separate from that, or was that part of what was considered a whole abstinence-only education?
Let me say, I think for the past 3 years, Governor Rita has amended that kind of provision. So, but at that time, yes, it looks like there were community-oriented organizations that were doing bits and pieces, but officially, it was not, the mandate was not to conduct HIV, sexuality, let me put it this way, the broader group of sexuality education, including HIV/AIDS, in schools across the state. So that was what was prevalent at that time. So, but it has then since been changed. But it also indicates the degree to which I think probably it could be a good way of examining some kind of natural experiment to look at before and after. But probably that could be another kind of study.
I know I already asked the question, but I have two more questions, one for you and one for you. I can ask them together if that's what they want to do. So mine for you was just, I actually was surprised by the findings that homeless youth use computers so much, because I work with low-income youth, and the idea is like we're also trying to integrate technology, but you know, we're fighting literature that talks about the digital divide with people that have and have not. So I'm just curious to you know, more to pick your brain than a real question, just how you think those associations can be used with like people who have traditionally been outside of the bubble of technology.
Sure. I think one of the issues with the digital divide is that the digital divide has a big age interaction effect. So the digital divide is much more, there's a class divide and a race divide that's more prevalent among older people than it is among younger people. So youth, teenagers today, there's so much of, there's a big uptake of this. I mean, we're not talking about new adaptation or fusion of new innovations anymore. This is technology that's been around for a while. And so it's really, you know, MySpace and Facebook has become as integral to the lives of adolescents as telephone was 20 years ago. So, and also remember that the cost of a cell phone is really low these days. And so even young people from fairly impoverished backgrounds view this as an essential sort of accessory to their lives and go out of their way to get it. And it's cheaper than direct habit, that's for sure. And so I think that there's ways in which the digital divide issue is probably still going to exist in terms of the adaptation of new technologies, the you know, taking on
new expensive toys. Like, I mean, I'm sure that there aren't a lot of iPad-owning homeless youth, right?
Yeah.
I mean, but if you're talking about, you know, a $50 cell phone that's pay-as-you-go minutes, there it's widespread among these young people in poverty. So it's not a simple situation.
Yeah, so I guess you're saying, like, with youth, as we're thinking about using technology as an intervention in programs, it's probably more useful than less useful than we would have thought with their parents or their grandparents.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's important. What I think my data says more than anything else is that young people living in extreme poverty, like homeless youth, are not that different in terms of their using of technology than normative housed adolescents. And so really, I think the issue then is to think, if we think that these might be good tools for reaching out to normal, to housed adolescents or normal adolescents, we shouldn't be excluding homeless youth from that as well, or youth living in poverty.
And then my question for you was, I was also interested in the framing in which you talked about the incarcerated youth once they return, like their risk behaviors are probably because of some type of deprivation.
Exactly.
And you know, I guess the myth, or maybe who knows if it's really a myth, in fact, of returning incarcerated, returning adults and youth is that, oh, they've been raped in jail, so now they're here giving HIV and AIDS to their communities. So I'm just wondering if you thought about the direction of your particular research and reframing that, the way in which we understand newly, you know, reintegrated youth and adults into our community after they've been incarcerated.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, that's something that we're continuing to think about, and the data set, you know, definitely has a lot of rich data that can inform any type of prevention activities and, you know, making recommendations about services that can be provided to reintegrate people and to you know, make them less risky and address that stigma about everyone who comes out of prison, you know, being infected with an STI or having HIV. That's a huge thing, definitely.
It's just about 10 minutes, but if there's any other questions that folks want to ask, I'm going to sit down.